Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Board of Supervisors' regular meeting on October 4th, 2023. Let's all stand for the pledge and honor flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Do we have someone to adopt?
Yep. Do we have any changes?
I do. Madam Chair, I got just a couple things to add for discussion or potential action for one. One is the James River Water Authority, the special use permit fee waiver. Again, we'll discuss how to basically the James River Water Authority is applying for a special use permit to Fluvanna County. And so
it's going to be under new, right?
It would be under new business. And then the second one is Zoom meeting discussion, just with some of the incidences we've had recently.
And
May
have a motion by Mr. Sheridan and second by Mr. Fairchild to adopt the agenda with the two items added to the business. All in favor?
Aye.
And chair votes aye. So we have one person absent, Mr. Bryan. Okay. Now we have a special presentation.
Madam Chair, I would say right at the moment we might want to move on.
I don't see
Lieutenant Wrench right here, and I'm seeing Captain Peterson throwing me some signs.
Is anybody getting in his place?
At 4 o'clock, we believed he was going to be here. So.
I reached out to him, so I'll see what he says.
Okay. So maybe we go on with the other stuff.
Yeah. All right. County Administrator's report.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, Madam Chair, members of the board, a few things to report here this evening. So one, got some new staff to introduce. One, we got Ben Frazier, started in the Planning and Zoning Department. He's the code inspector and code enforcement officer. He started September 25th. So we got Ben Frazier right down here. And so like I said, I'd like to introduce him to the county staff and wanted to just kind of introduce him to the board, so.
Yeah, go ahead, Ben. Pleased to meet you folks. My name is Ben Frazier. I prefer Ben if you see me in the hall. I am a Army veteran. I have previous building experience, 18 years. My father and I own a building business in Fluvanna County here. I was also one of his foremen as well, so I am a hands-on kind of guy. I'm also a small business owner here in the county, or was. I owned my own home inspection firm here in the county for 10 years as well. So. And I've been here as a resident in the county for 20 years, worked in the county since 94.
So.
Welcome. So like I said, we're glad to have him on the team. And like I said, he'll bring a lot of good knowledge and expertise to the planning zoning department.
So how long have you been with the inspector?
Since right around mid-March.
Yeah, about 5-6 months.
Yeah. Yeah, but Andy Wills and I are getting him up to speed. Mm-hmm. He's been shadowing Johnny, Andy, myself,
right.
Getting him cross-trained in all disciplines for building, ENS, and planning and zoning inspections.
Thank you.
Yep.
Happy.
Good. And then also on the screen, we have Troy Hodge, no relation to Tim Hodge.
I'm sure, yeah.
He's a new information system specialist working in the information technology department. He's also started September 25th. We also have Dustin Richardson. This was a new position that the board approved for the current fiscal year. Also started in the IT department for the IT systems engineer. He just started Monday, October 2nd. And then Kelly Tyree started as a library assistant one, and she started October 2nd as well. So I'd like to welcome those new staff members to the county.
They take the best pictures.
They do.
They have the nicest smile.
It's all good lighting in the hallway,
yeah.
Right?
Good. Do you do those?
No. No, that's Donna. Donna Snow and Mary does it. Yeah.
Very good,
huh? Yeah. So last week there was a public hearing, or really call it a community meeting, public hearing for VDOT regarding the Route 600, 618 intersection improvements, which is basically down at South Boston Road and Lake Monticello Road, kind of at the bottom of the dam before you go over the Rivanna River there. So just to kind of, just so the public's aware, you know, what VDOT's intending to do is add a left turn lane at Route 600 and 618. They'll also be doing some site distance improvements along Route 618. Again, that intersection was identified as a priority by the county and also kind of through VDOT. Looking at the history of angle and rear end crashes, and that project was selected for funding through VDOT's Smart Scale funding in 2018. So the 2020 traffic count shows an average of 6,600 vehicles use Route 600 per day, and an average daily traffic on Route 618 is about 2,600 vehicles a day. The one thing that is good for the public to know and for the board to know, so during construction, between right on Route 618, that road will be temporarily closed for 10 months, is what they're anticipating. So basically, if you think about where the Riverside Gate is, going down to Lake Monticello Road, that section of the road will be closed. Now, VDOT is still accepting, again, since it was a public hearing, they're still accepting comments on kind of what is being proposed. The link down there will bring people to the VDOT page, which shows a kind of a big brochure about everything. But again, the bottom down here really kind of shows the detour. I mean, the biggest takeaway, I think, is, let's just say, for instance, if you live in Sycamore Square or something along that area and you travel to Richmond or Zion's Crossroads, instead of being able to go down South Boston Road, you're going to have to go back, either one, go all around 53, because Lake Monticello Road, you'll still be able to get onto routes South Boston Road from Lake Monticello Road, but it'll just be closed in that one section. So if you lived in, say for instance, Sycamore Square, you'd either have to go all the way up to 53, all the way around, and come back down Lake Monticello Road to go to Zion's, or take South Boston Road back to 53, take 53 to Palmyra, and then take 15 north. So talking to VDOT a little bit during that public hearing, I mean, it's certainly gonna add from a drive time for some of those individuals at least 10 to 15 minutes potentially by having to do some of those detours. Now, for instance, if you live within the gates of Lake Monticello, or let's just say you lived in the Riverside section of Lake Monticello, or you have a Lake Monticello sticker, you could drive through the Riverside Gate, take Jefferson Drive up to the main gate, then come back down Lake Monticello Road to South Boston Road if you're going to like Zion's Crossroads or 64.
So you're gonna be able to take a left turn down there, and you just won't be able to turn right?
No, that whole, so here's, if you see right there, that's the intersection. Right. It's going to be closed right there going all the way back up to the Riverside Gate. That whole section of the road will be closed to through traffic is what they're anticipating. And they're anticipating a 10-month span. Now, we could always talk to VDOT. We had conversations with VDOT about it before that, you know, what other things could we do so we didn't have to close the road down. They would have to get into some type of automated signaling on that stretch of the road, which would allow one-way traffic. That would then make the construction period a lot longer. Obviously, if they have the road closed, they can do it quicker. But 10 months is a pretty substantial period of time for people that travel that. But so anyway, the link down there will bring people to the page of VDOT, and they can make public comments as well. And if the board has any questions or comments or anything, you know, I can certainly bring those back to VDOT representatives as well.
I brought this up at one point down when they were fixing a one-lane bridge in Kinston, and it took 8 months to fix it. And during that time, a bridge almost collapsed or something happened to a six-lane highway in Charlottesville. It was fixed in 4 days.
That's a good question. I'll ask VDOT.
I'm sure that it has something to do with the moving the land, and they didn't have to move land or something of that nature. But
10 months does seem like a long time for an existing intersection to just enhance it. I know I say just, but.
Yeah, they're going to be doing lots of widening, bringing in dirt to widen it. I mean, again, it does seem like a pretty long period of time.
I'm sure they'll just say, that dirt they bring in has to settle. You can't just put paper.
Well, yeah, they're going to have to compact it. But anyway, if the board or the public wants more information, certainly VDOT's webpage has more, really a vast of specific information to this. Also, October is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month, a time dedicated to remembering victims whose lives ended too soon as a result of domestic violence, and offering safety and support for those currently in abusive relationships, and celebrating survivors who are now free from their abusers. According to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, 1 in 3 women and 1 in 4 men in the U.S. experience some form of physical violence from a partner. Children are negatively impacted by witnessing abuse in the home. Sometimes children become abusers themselves. Victims stay with their abusers for many reasons, fear, threats of killing them, or just a lot of different reasons. Abuse from a partner is not normal, is not okay. We have a great special Fluvanna Victim Witness Assistance Program that assists with that. So if anyone in the public is experiencing violence in a relationship or you know someone, you can reach out to the Fluvanna Victim Witness Coordinator in the Commonwealth Attorney's Office at the number 434-591-1985, or also Shelter for Help and Emergency, SHE, at 434-293-8509. And then we've got a ribbon cutting occurring October 7th at 11 a.m. So Sweet Art Emporium, which was right down here in Palmyra, they're actually moving up to Turkey Sag Trail right there, Jennifer, right next to, kind of by Salon DeShano there in that stretch.
Food Line,
that's right, I'm sorry, thank you. On the other section, down a few spots from the Food Line, I think
where the ice cream used to be.
Yes, I think that's what it was. Yeah, down a few.
Near Subway. Next to
yes,
Subway.
Yes, next to Subway. Yes, correct. Yeah, so that's occurring October 7th at 11 a.m.
Not that I would know where the ice cream shop is.
And then also some upcoming regular meetings. Again, October 18th, we have a regular meeting at 7 p.m. November 1st at 5 p.m. is a regular meeting, and Wednesday, November 15th at 7 p.m. we have a regular meeting. One thing I wanted to ask the board, so there's been some back and forth, I know, regarding getting some more information on solar, and Mr. Sheridan had a contact that submitted a letter to the board about, getting some more information. I was wondering if the board would want to set up maybe a work session at the October 18th meeting, or if not, we could have the individual come and just do a presentation to the board. You know, the presentation to the board certainly is a little more limited, but the board can let it go as long as they want, or we could do a work session from 5 to 6:30 and break for closed session, or whatever the board wants to do to ask questions, get more information. I mean, we certainly are ramping up. We've got a couple special use permit applications for solar that are coming forward. One with CEP Solar, and also for Pine Gate Renewables. They submitted for October 1st. I mean, coming down the road here in the next 2 to 3 months, solar is going to be kind of coming through the Planning Commission at the board. So, does the board want me to set up anything for a work session, or just do a presentation? Next meeting, we do have a couple public hearings. We have 4 public hearings for
2. The next one 4 in November, I think.
Refresh my memory what they are again.
Give me just a second. There's a quick claim deed, solar, and occupancy tax.
Yeah, that's right. We've got public hearings for the occupancy tax for the revenue share, and then for the quitclaim deed for the Freehill Cemetery. I mean, so nothing too controversial or anything like that.
That's
so
on the 18th.
That's on the 18th meeting, yes. So just want to get some indication from the board. Would you want to do something at a work session or just do a presentation?
Where is he coming from?
He's coming from South Halifax. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, he lives in Charlotte right now, but he works in both. So I can't tell exactly where he's coming from, but it's pretty close to Stanford.
And I'd have to coordinate with it was Mr. Lane Gunn to see if he's available at that time. I'm just trying to get some options from the board. And we could push it back to the November 1st meeting, too, if you wanted to do a presentation. I just know we've got some things coming up and just wanted to kind of just...
As long as we think we know what our questions are, at least in part, you know, what we're trying to figure out, and, you know, to be able to take up a bit of a work session. I mean, I certainly don't mind. As you say, stuff's coming, about to hit the, come in front of us.
Yeah, and I know the letter that he sent to you was, you know, kind of talked about, you know, some of the, you know, different things about, you know, traffic, and I don't have the letter right in front of me.
Traffic and lay of the land and angles to keep vegetation alive, grow, things of that
nature. Erosion and sediment control, things like that, and, you know.
I'll just tell you, that's what he's been having to do for the last 2 years. And he's got another 3 years of work in front of him, so we're not talking about dealing with him.
Yeah.
As far as I know.
And what does their business do again? They consult...
He works for a construction business. He is also the president of this. We've got the Central Virginia business thing coming before us. He's the president of the Southern Central Virginia.
Yeah, and really what else? Really the. I can't remember what it is. Something alliance, and really what they do, they
Small Business Alliance, that's what the last thing
they kind of coordinate with these solar projects, trying to put them in connection with local businesses, where if these projects are coming forward, it's trying to use more local businesses rather than getting businesses coming from outside the area too. That was kind of one of the things, but the gentleman also worked for a development company, and so he's been involved in some of the solar projects. So we
don't know how much time he would need in order to make his presentation, but I think we need to spend the time that we need and not expect him to come here and do 10, 15 minutes.
No, I mean, I think it would be good if the board had some specific questions that they wanted to ask in advance, and so he could come prepared with some things, but there may be some things that are just popping up on the fly as
discussions that we aren't aware of, but we haven't done. I think that's one of the things he talked to me about. Because he's been involved with this stuff, he might be able to answer some of the questions or let us know some of the things.
And I know Mr. Witten also, through some emails, also, what was the company?
Advanced Strategy is Rocka.
Yeah.
It's basically a group that represents a lot of localities that are considering solar, from Prince Edward, Halifax, Charlotte, Greensville County, I think Sussex, Surrey, Prince George County, are kind of members of that group. So he's just a good resource, and a lot of these in the General Assembly, so he kind of knows all the solar bills that are coming out, and if there's requests from localities, he's a lot of people that helps lobby these bills. So
I'll guarantee you two of them know each other.
I'm sure.
I'm good with it. I appreciate your efforts in coming. At the same time, I'm just trying to figure out how we find a balanced, consulted on a balanced way. Clearly, he's in the business of helping to make them happen, but they have a capitalist. I think it's wonderful. I just wonder, you know, if we're going to get how we also get the other side of the conversation, if there is one.
I will just tell you this much. There was nobody I knew that was trying to figure out the best way to put this. More trying to slow it down than him. And then the company he worked for it's paying the bills for those guys. If that makes sense. So he sees it from both sides.
I'd say let's have a work session and see what we take away from it. And
then if we need another one, we ask for one.
So does the board want to do something, try and do something on October 18th that Mr. Gunn is available?
I'd say either the 18th or the 1st or something of that nature. You know, we'll give him an option.
Well, the 1st and
the... We have something coming. We have solar...
Or 15th.
...on the 1st, a public hearing. Do we have any solar coming to us?
No. We don't have solar on the 1st. We we don't have any more public hearings until November 15th. I mean, again, on the 1st, it's a 5 p.m. regular meeting, so, you know, we would have to do the work session after we went through the regular meeting, if you wanted to do a work session.
Well, if you do it, give them the 18th and the 15th, see if one works.
If that works for the board, I can try and arrange that.
I apologize, what am I missing?
We were just talking about the email that Mr. Lane Gunn sent about doing some solar discussion, and just... proposing either we do a work session at before the next meeting on October 18th, or we did one November 1 after the regular meeting, because the regular meeting starts at 5 p.m. So those were kind of the two options. But if the board's fine with that, I can try and schedule something. And again, maybe if you all have some specific questions you're looking for, I think that would be really helpful too. Like I said, I think you'll definitely have some things, and there'll be some on-the-fly conversation. But
I'd say the sooner the better. So if you can make it on the 18th, great. Yeah. If not, then the 15th.
Okay. Sounds good. Okay, great. And then just one reminder, too, October 21st, which is a Saturday, coffee and conversations. Kelly, what's the time again? 9?
I think we made it
10 to 12.
10 to 12 coffee conversations like we did at the Fork Union Community Center, at Fluena Community Center. We're doing it at the
10 to 1.
Thank you. We're doing it at the Lake Monticello Firehouse.
We said we are advertising this, right?
We are. Yeah. We put it in put it in fan mail originally, and then for the next 2 weeks, the two Thursdays beforehand, we're putting in the Flu Banner Review as well, just to advertise for it, and then we'll push it out and, you know, put it on fan mail, and I guess put it on the one of the county social media pages.
Yeah.
And then that can be pushed out as well.
Did you say it was 10 to 1. Yeah, okay. All right.
Let's make sure it's right on the calendar.
Okay, so now we are ready to open. You finished any questions for Aaron on the report? If not, we're going to open our first public comments. Anyone would like to speak to the board, please come to the lectern and give your name and address, and you have 5 minutes to speak to the board. Anyone would like to come, you're welcome. Anyone online?
I don't see anyone coming off mute. There's only maybe one person that went online. So.
And I don't think she can come off mute on her own. So maybe we need to remind people to raise their hands.
Yeah, okay, because we made some initial changes within the Zoom to...
Right, so you have to raise your hand if you'd like to speak.
Yeah.
If you're on Zoom.
Yeah.
Okay, so we don't have anyone. So I'm going to close the public comments. And we will go to action matters. A, selection of voting credentials for the 2020 Fluvaco annual business meeting.
So again, this is just kind of a reoccurring thing, pretty simple. Yeah. Again, Vaco bylaws state that each county shall designate a representative of its board of supervisors to cast its vote at the annual business meeting. The association bylaws also allow to designate a non-elected official from the county. Or another one to cast proxy votes. Again, for your county to be certified to vote at the annual business meeting, a completed voting credentials form or proxy statement must be submitted to VACO by November 7th. So that was in the board package, and again, we do it every year. It's pretty simple, and so if the board wants to really nominate who is the
I've got to be there.
What are we voting on? I was trying to find out what are we voting on.
It's just agreeing with the agenda that's approved.
Okay.
Over there.
It's the NACO.
But there's nothing real controversial we need to discuss.
No, it's NACO's legislation and where they stand on different pieces of legislation moving forward.
All right, so we need a motion. Mr. Chardon would like to do that. So we need a motion.
I move the Board of Supervisors approve Mr. Mike Sheridan, the appointed voting delegate representative from Benning County, for casting votes at the 2023 annual business meeting of the Virginia Association of Counties.
Second. All right. Motion by Mrs. Speaker and second by Mr. O'Brien that Mr. Sheridan will be our voting delegate at the federal meeting. All in favor?
Aye.
And Chair votes aye.
I'm taking this one out.
Okay.
4-0-1.
4-0-1. And two, that's for the alternate?
Yeah, as an alternate in case for some reason Mr. Sheridan can't make it, get sick, something happens, and so.
If we're in the football playoffs tonight, please come back to practice.
Anyone want to volunteer to be an alternate?
Are you going to be there, Mr. Ball?
I'm going to be there. I'm going to say it can be a board member.
I can be, it can be a board member. It can be Mr. Dahl.
Okay. I think you, the board appointed
Let's
me last
year.
Thank you and I have been the two appointees since you got.
I know the Board of Supervisors of the American Dahl to be appointed as the delegate representing the Wright County by casting votes at the 2023 annual business meeting of the Virginia Association.
All right. Motion was made by Mr. O'Brien and seconded by Mrs. Speaker. All in favor? Chair votes aye. So next we have the B, Fourth Amendment to Software as a Service Agreement to add merchant card services and card payment systems as an additional service with Tyler Technologies, Inc. by Mr. Dahl.
So this is a milestone, and I'm sure Ms. Lenher will be very happy to see this moving forward. So this will, again, doesn't mean it's going to be implemented immediately, but this is the contract that we've been going back and forth on to get favorable terms for the county to be able to accept credit card payments throughout the county. So we'll just kind of go through here. So one, the county issued an RFP, request for proposals for merchant card services and card payment systems for the online payment system project, which includes labor, assistance, equipment, maintenance, warranties, customer services, blah, 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 which kind of is the additional services. So Tyler submitted its proposal in response to the RFP, and further, Tyler agreed to certain revised pricing as set forth in the sales quotation. Some of the additional services that this contract will include is Tyler Payments software applications, necessary consultation to define scope of services, implementation of software and services, and training and support for the software and services. So one, Tyler will provide services for processing payments online through Munis and Intergov Citizen Self-Service, and future versions of online portals. It will also allow to process payments over the counter and into Tyler cashiering module, eliminating manual and two-step processing. So for Ms. Lenher's office, what that does is it allows a seamless transaction of the payments coming in and then going right into our financial software system without duplication or two steps having to be completed. Tyler will provide payment terminals which are compatible with cashiering, and then Tyler's payment solution provides real-time processing with streamlined reconciliation process with one vendor. So the cost, there are certain costs. I mean, really the cost to the county is fees for the additional services, basically for the card readers, which basically is, for the first year would be $2,736 per year. There's an escalation for those amounts to go up, but it's not a whole lot. And then just on some of the screens, this just kind of gives, and this was in the board package too, some of the transaction fees for the different per card transactions, whether it's a $295 or $120 transaction cap for utility billing, also for these types of different payments, whether over-the-counter utility billing, real estate, personal property taxes, building inspections, planning, 2.95% or $2.50 minimum. There's a e-check fee of $1.25 per electronic e-check transaction, and then just some fees for, you know, if there's any checks that get returned or rejected, and then just kind of outlining some of the annual fees as well. Again, this has been a long time going, and I'll certainly rely on Linda if she wants to make any comments about this, but this allows us to move forward with it. We were trying to push them for a tighter time frame as far as committing to getting the implementation completed. We were hoping to get it done by, we originally were pushing them for June, by getting done really by April, so it could be implemented by June taxes of this spring. They would not commit to that. So we pushed it out until basically October of 2024. So we basically have, they have a year to get it implemented. And then there's some provisions in there, but we got the contract in place, and we will certainly try and get it implemented sooner, but certainly working with the treasurer's office, you know, we don't want to do any of the implementation during any of the tax collection period, so we have some discrete times to get all the implementation and training, and Linda, do you want to speak on anything?
Yes, we've been working on this for 3.5 years. Citizens really want this. And I just don't know why it's going to take so long to do this, but as long as we get that contract signed and we can pin down Tyler and get this out there for the other departments in this county, I mean, it won't be in my term, but, you know, it needs to be done.
At least you have a little part in it.
Yes.
Before December. So,
yes.
Yes.
You can still write checks, correct?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, this is just
only for people that want to do by credit card or an e-check online.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, no, we're going to still take checks. We process.
Take checks. You can go in there and give them cash.
Yes.
All that stuff.
Yes,
that was the thing he was talking about, is if they do that, you can punch it right in and the credit is
right
there.
And currently, using a third-party official payments, I have to have a staff member that takes that credit card report and manually post it into your account. This way, it's gonna be a streamline. It will pay it instantly.
Good. Okay.
I agree that it is what it is, but I agree that a year to get this implemented is almost like they have to write the software. I mean, good Lord, doesn't it exist in, but,
I agree. I was pushing for, to have it done by April so we could get it done by the next
June cycle.
Yeah, by
yes.
the June cycle, but they would not. They
would
not commit to that.
Well, so, I commend Linda and Dan. He and I talked about this a meeting or two ago after the meeting outside, and I certainly sense that Dan was going to help this move along too. And to all of you, I appreciate you getting this done. And I know the citizens of, it's going to be a big deal for them. It's a bit archaic that we have been where we have been at this point.
The other one that would be big for is Aaron and Parks and Rec with all the,
yes.
every time kids and stuff are doing stuff like that.
Well, I think the biggest thing, I mean, for like the building inspections department, I mean, they're trying to go so much where, you know, they get a lot of contractors and stuff that are doing business. This will allow things to happen a lot more electronically. You know, not having to come in and bring a check for a building, or, you know, for a building permit or things like that, or anything they're doing with the county.
Yeah,
yeah.
Do it on site.
Yeah.
And
chill
too.
What's that?
And
yeah.
It's
going to
help you too. It's going to help our water department also.
Yeah.
Because we do have people that want to pay that
yes.
online monthly.
Well, too, as we, you know, get all of our systems, our sewer system, the new Zion's Crossroads system, as we start moving forward.
We're moving into the 21st century, right?
Yes. taking a while to get there.
Yeah, it takes a while.
I think it was 3.5 years.
Yes, 3.5 years. Wow.
Yes, ma'am.
All right.
So there's two motions, one for the agreement, and then motion two is really everything IT kind of related falls in IT's budget. So this was to allocate, because we didn't know what the annual cost was necessarily going to be to put 2736 into the IT budget.
Okay. We need someone to make motion one, please.
I move the Board of Supervisors approve the Fourth Amendment to Software as a Service Agreement to add merchant card services and card payment systems as an additional service between Flibana County and Tyler Technologies Incorporated, Munis, for the purpose of adding merchant card services and card payment systems at a cost of $2,736 for terminal rentals for the first year, and other amounts as incurred to be renewable and subject to increases as set forth in the Fourth Amendment, and further authorize the county administrator to execute the amendment subject to approval as to form by the county attorney. And I move, go ahead and read both.
Yep.
And I move the Board of Supervisors approve the submitter merchant payment processing instructions and guidelines required by the county, by J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, N.A., and necessary for processing related to the Fourth Amendment, and further authorize the county administrator to execute the guidelines subject to approval as to form by the county attorney.
All right, do we have a second?
Sorry, one clarification. The deputy county attorney will actually be signing this form. It was already that way in the contract, and I didn't want to go back and get it to change.
Okay.
So if she can make it to the deputy county attorney, Christina Hoffman will be signing as the form.
Yeah, she's been the one doing the deep dive in this role.
Okay. Did you second? Okay. We have the motion by Mr. Sheridan, second by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Chair votes aye. And motion number two.
I move the Board of Supervisors approve a budget transfer of $2,736 from the FY24 BOS contingency budget to the information technology budget for the annual card terminal fees.
Okay. All right, the motion was made by Mrs. Speaker and second by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
And then chair votes aye.
And again, with that one, if we get it implemented by June billing, we will need the funding. If we don't get it implemented, then we won't need it, so.
Okay. All right, now it's time for us to do our special
thank y'all very much.
Thank you.
Presentation. And we do see here,
yeah.
Mr. Ritz, Thomas Ritz has come down. And you have the honor.
Yeah, you're coming back. There's a good couple of weeks. I just forgot to take the time on the clock.
Okay.
I am just about there.
All right. Congratulations on your retirement, Lieutenant Thomas Rent, Deputy Sheriff, Levanna County Sheriff's Office, July 1, 1998 to August 31st, 2023. In appreciation of your 25 years of dedicated service to the County of Levanna, best wishes for a long and happy retirement. Levanna County Board of Supervisors, Levanna County, Virginia.
Thank you. Here you go.
Club. No, that's fine.
don't have any appointments, so we're going for presentations. Central Virginia Small Business Development Center update. Jennifer, are you starting or me?
You threw me off. I thought we were doing public hearings first. good evening, Jennifer Schmack, Economic Development Director. So as you know, we're a small but mighty department, and we leverage the support of our community partners to really help our business community. So I have with me tonight Rebecca Haydock. She's the director of the Central Virginia Small Business Development Center, to give you kind of an overview of the last year and tell you some things that we're working on.
Yes.
Okay. Thank
Welcome.
You.
Thank you.
Nice to see you all. So thanks for having me. We wanted to give you an update, but first I wanted to say the numbers keep going like this. You know, I thought when the pandemic hit and I first started this role, and I met Rudy, and I met Brian, and I met you, and I met so many others, and the numbers for Fluvanna just started climbing. When this one showed up, they jumped again.
Yes.
So I'm like, wow, we're seeing so many Fluvanna businesses. So. Really exciting.
It's a good problem to have, right?
Well, actually, our whole board, our advisory board meeting was all about what are we going to do, because I'm worried about losing business advisors because we're working them so hard, but we have some strategies. We're working on figuring out how to manage the continuing climb. But I want to give you all an update, let you know what's been going on, what's been happening over the last year, some of the things that we're working on, and be here to answer any questions that you have. Thank you. I don't do a click. You're the clicker. Thank you. So, for the third year in a row, your little SBDC has been the top ranked in the state. It's mostly because we have the highest number of clients, the highest hours, the most programs, most job created. Our companies are raising money. They're getting the money that they're trying to go after. So, just wanted to share that, and it's all still free of charge and totally confidential for the businesses. This is, you know, I think you're all pretty familiar with who we are and what we do, but just wanted to go over quickly. We did get a few new tools that we use now. We're doing SEM Rush SEO reports for business plans and for business websites, letting people update those now. That's all free of charge, as well as all kinds of industry assistance. We've got a number of companies that are exporting. So that's become, the International Trade Group has really become a bigger focus. We had an international trade conference this past year that helped a lot of those businesses. QuickBooks, the typical research, of course, we help a lot with record keeping, buying and selling businesses, things like that. So all the usual you would expect from all different types of businesses. Oh, sorry, can we get back up?
Sure.
The information on the bottom is finally new. So. We did this survey, it was done by America's SBDCs. We had the same information since 2017, now we had an update. Average annual sales growth is 16.6% for those that get mentoring and advising through the SBDC versus 8% for non-SBDC businesses. So really helpful data that shows, you know, when people have mentors and access to resources and the latest tools, they're getting what they need. And of course, employment growth is higher as well with those types of businesses. So just wanted to share that data. That's an update finally. Okay, next. Thanks. So you all know about what's happening this weekend. Sweetheart Emporium, so exciting. 70 businesses represented there. She's just an amazing client. I won't read the quote, but she provided a quote for us and, you know, has been a CIC graduate and a long-term SBDC client as well. Just a great, successful business, which you all know about. So, anything you wanted to share about?
No,
okay.
Great is her day.
Yeah. Erica's amazing. We spent a good amount of time with her, and she's just fabulous. Yeah. Okay. So here's the numbers. We added another year. You can see, right? It just keeps going up. You all are producing a lot of great businesses, and we're talking to them. And spending some time there. So I also won't go through all of this in detail, but you know, unique clients served, that is at, I think, 61. You know, client hours keep going up. Jobs created is low this time. We didn't have a lot of new jobs. And we also didn't get a lot of startups, a lot of new startups, but that's not unusual, right? There was an awful lot of activity after the pandemic, and we're seeing stability in those businesses. We haven't seen any of our clients in this county close. So that's good news. Next slide. So this one, they're attending the training events, and we're also accessing training events from across the state and curating events from those that have great content, as well as we held over 70 of our own this year again. But capital is down. That can actually be viewed as good news, meaning that the businesses did not need to go after loans, equity capital or other capital. So we're seeing a pretty healthy state for the Flubana businesses. So that's, we think, why that number is not up. There were a lot of good loan recipients last year though. Okay, so what did we do specifically for Flubana County in the last year? It was a lot. We're here, we have office hours now regularly on a monthly basis, where a business advisor is here every month. But we also were involved with the Chamber Women's Conference training on early stage capital. I actually came and spoke and delivered information on that. And there's another, unfortunately, there's a lot of me, I hate being in pictures, but I did the Business 101 class and taught that here. We had our digital expert do a digital marketing strategy class, as well as two subsequent workshops to work through strategies with companies. We've been at several Flubana Connection meetings. We had the Building Your Social Media workshops. I mentioned the office hours. And our new advisor that is covering all the rural counties, Rosie Beachy, came for the commercial kitchen opening, which was really exciting. So also we did a Flubana Founders Series. It was 4 evening sessions, a cohort for entrepreneurs, and we used 5 different business advisors to get that accomplished. And some of those folks received their entrepreneurship certificate. The entrepreneurship certificate has really been growing. It's a 5-part training series with homework in between that gets people to a business plan, or at least to some good financial projections and business stability and marketing and so on. And that's becoming interestingly popular for people giving out grants. They want to see that people have either been through that or the CIC workshop or some other, you know, somewhat long-term, pretty inclusive business training that covers a lot of topics. So that's been interesting. We're there for the social media Rotary presentation. Of course, there's been pitch prep for Quad Tank. Next year, we didn't do Quad Tank this year, and the counties have agreed to not continue that. So there will be a final on that next year. I don't think there'll be a conference, but just the pitch competition. And we will do the trainings that are involved to get people ready for that. And now, Jennifer and I are working together on the Small Business Administration Portable Assistance Grant. That is up to $100,000 for 3 years, so $300,000, and we're looking at it for Fork Union. She and I are working together on the application. The draft is actually due next week, so we're really working on it. And we're hoping that we will get that grant, and it is for revitalization. It can only run through SBDC, so it's being run through the George Mason University, Virginia SBDC, but we are applying for it specifically for Fork Union.
Can you define what portable assistance is?
It is, there's no match required for this grant. It is to basically install support, and typically in the form of, you know, SBDC advisors, other resources and tools in a community that has suffered job loss and has shown economic downturn. So it's actually getting people in that community, meeting with the community, doing the work to revitalize that community. So, you know, not considering it, you know, as a remote territory, but really being there. So that's why it's a reasonable amount of money, and it allows you to hire someone to focus on that effort.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Okay, next. So to the entire territory, things that we keep, you know, running and going, we've got the 40-plus page website that has tool training resources. We do a twice-monthly newsletter, which has an immense amount of business content. We do over 70 trainings a year and offer others, and some examples are there. The Business Essentials, SWAMP certification, government contracting, human resource assistance, and QuickBooks and record keeping are always popular, as is marketing. This is the team. So Rosie Beachy is the rural county business advisor. So she travels to all of the rural counties. Yep, thank you. Mesa is our client services coordinator. She spends about a little over 20 hours a week dealing directly with clients, getting them to the resources they need. Also doing industry market research and other market research for companies. Shira is the events coordinator, who also keeps track of the website, the newsletter, does all our communications work, supports all of the community activity and getting things scheduled. And then myself, Ariel is Charlottesville and Albemarle, focused on that. We had Rosie and Ariel kind of crossing over based on their expertise, but we decided that was kind of messy and confusing. But we do, you know, we share clients. And I am focused, I'm about a half-time business advisor, they're both full-time, and I'm focused on the high-tech, high-growth, equity, capital, international trade types of clients. We still have 6 contractors, we're down from about 12. Some of them we're using very little, but our core business advisors that we keep busy are Ellen, who's on the right, she's the QuickBooks advisor, who really helps people with technical issues and record keeping so they can get their loans and handle their financing. Mary is a grant specialist, so she's called in when a business has an opportunity for grants. She's been very busy with our agribusinesses and getting a number of grants for them. That's been great. Linda specializes in government contracting. Greg McFetridge has been a lender for 40 years. He's great with buying and selling businesses and complicated financial deals that need a lot of different sources of capital. And then Jay Lester and Tom Kelly are the two that really work with the high-growth technology-based businesses, sort of as backup. But again, we're not using them nearly as much as we did in the past because, you know, we're limited in size, and all of that CARES Act money went away. So, but they're still there, and they're still willing to work with us, and they're really valuable when we plug them in. And then at the bottom are just some of the advisors that we don't pay for. They're with other entities or organizations, but they work with us free of charge, and they work with us. So our ask, you know, again, we're always asking for support. We would love a full match from Fluvanna. About 9.5% of our clients come from Fluvanna. We ask for the same amount from every municipality. That has increased 3%. We haven't asked for an increase in 4 years. And so that's a small incremental increase that would bring Fluvanna to about 7.4% of the municipal total of our total budget. SBA matches half of the municipal funding. We raise the rest. That is mostly coming from, there's a couple of grants that we get small percentages of. It requires us to hire more people to do more things, but we get a little bit of administrative support for this core team. We have private donors. We have a foundation that has provided $75,000 for 3 years. That ends in 2025, so we've got to figure out what's going to happen there, or maybe we can convince them to keep funding us. And one thing that's filled the gaps quite substantially in the last year and will also be part of this year is county paid programming, where people have asked us to do half-day conferences or host the Business Essentials training, do community business launch work, and we provide all of the technical training, and that last year was about $36,000, so it really helps. And yeah, that's it. This is who we serve.
And for the record, there's no official funding request. This is just pre-budget, a pre-budget ask.
Yep, yep. Mm-hmm. Yes, I have homework to do. All right. Any questions about anything?
Any questions? I'll ask one that doesn't have anything to do with this.
Sure.
You've heard us talking about guy that's going to come speak to us?
Yeah.
He's the president of the South Central Virginia. Is that's part of this also?
This, are you talking about the solar person that's coming?
Yes.
South Central Virginia.
Of the, is there a South Central Virginia Small Business District?
I don't know who that is. I think all the directors I know down there are women. I'll have to.
He's
affiliated somehow with the Small Business Development Center.
I don't think it's small business. It's slightly different.
It's got a bunch of letters.
Right, I know. It's horrible alphabet soup. Yeah. Ours is the worst. CVSPDC. It all sounds the same.
Yeah,
it's horrible.
Six or seven.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, thank you all so much. It's lovely to see you all. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ms. Jennifer. So next we have our Constitutional Office of Pay Policy update.
Yeah, so we were presented to the board before, and the board said just kind of reach out to some other localities and then kind of get some information. And again, just for the public that may or may not have been privy to the conversation before, so prior to January 18, 2017, the county did not have a policy to address starting salaries of newly elected constitutional officers. Again, what will occur before newly elected constitutional officers receive the pay of the previous incumbent. The Board of Supervisors adopted Personnel Policy 2.8.6, Constitutional Officer Pay, again on January 18, 2017. And then, again, it was requested to bring the pay policy back for supervisors review. And so this is just the policy right here. You know, it basically says that the starting salary will be based upon basically what is approved and reimbursed by the General Assembly and the state's compensation board. And the board may consider education experience, special skills or certifications, and proficiency in related formal roles when determining a higher starting salary. And then salary for interim appointments, again, it says a salary for an appointed interim constitutional officer will be the minimum. Again, we discussed that we think there needs to, at minimum, be some tweaks to this, using the example of, I think Mr. Haystuck used the example of, we'll say that he said, you know, I want to retire today, and say the interim appointment was the assistant Commonwealth attorney. That individual, for what the starting pay is for a Commonwealth attorney, would be less than that. So I think at a minimum, we need to make some tweaks in the language at that. But I don't want to bring anything forward before the board has a full decision on kind of where they want to go. And so pulling some information, and thank you to Ms. Snow. She got some information from some other localities on their starting pay. So just we just use four localities: Green, Louisa, Middlesex, and Powhatan. One, they do not have a constitutional officer policy in place currently. They either receive their starting pay as established by the comp board, or they use the compensation board starting pay as the basis and then negotiate an amount above that with the Board of Supervisors. And then Hanover County, they do have a constitutional officer pay policy, and it's kind of similar to Fluvanna's. Like Fluvanna, it uses the comp board as the basis for the starting salary and then allows for a higher amount based upon education, experience, and other factors. So again, when we kind of talked to the board last time this came forward, the board wanted to see just kind of what was, you know, just get a little sample of kind of what some other localities were doing. And so other localities are doing something at least similar to what we're doing, whether it's policy or not policy, or less than what we're currently doing. So, and like I said, if the board wants staff to pull out any other information, look for anything else, but that's kind of the basis for where it is. And I know the last meeting, Mr. Hayslip and Ms. Lenher were here to kind of speak on that. So happy to answer any questions from the board, or if Ms., you know, if you want to ask Ms. Lenher any questions, or if you want to, you know, get any thoughts from Ms. Snow as well.
Personally, I'm good with where we're at. I mean, I think it's good to look at it, but knowing we have the latitude to adjust it based upon somebody's credentials and so on coming into it, it says to me we just have a floor, but we have the latitude to build off of that floor as we choose.
Where's put our policy?
Okay. Yep. So that's the, those are the two sections of our policy. Those are the exact language.
We talked about changing D.
I think we need to add some language to be for existing employees that they stay at their current salary if they move into an interim appointment without going down to what the comp board is.
I would say that they should probably get more because they're assuming more responsibilities are going up. And if it's a small percentage, I mean, looking at that, I don't think they should stay the same if we're asking them to do more. We don't do that with anybody else, except county administrator.
Yeah, other than as a resume builder, I don't know why somebody would do it if they're not going to get paid more money for it.
I'm sorry, Mr. President.
Other than as a resume builder, I'm not sure why somebody would do it if they're not going to get a little more, a little something for it.
Well, I mean, I guess what we could do if the board wants to add something about at least keeping at least the salary that they're at, and I guess we could add something in there that however the board of supervisors may approve a higher starting salary and then kind of cut the last part of
that's 85%.
Well, it's a very specific situation. I mean, we have to have somebody who's been in that position for a fair period of time to get to the point where they're probably exceeding their boss's salary.
Or the minimum of the comp board, yeah.
It's a pretty exceptional situation.
It would be.
But if you're a deputy, let's say you're getting paid $75,000 and the minimum base for the constitutional officer is $85,000, or maybe you've been a deputy for 10 years and you're at $82,000.
Right.
So I mean, it's a pretty rare situation where we would encounter it. I think certainly at the discretion of the board is how we can do that.
Yeah, I think as long as we have the latitude to we can decide whatever at the time.
I'll tell you, I brought it up, I said it before. I'll leave it alone after this. I just think it's the position, not the person in the position that we pay. And I know that when we compared salaries a long time ago, ours were pretty significantly behind others, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, but when we did the big comp study, and so everyone's...
Got more, yes. I'm not sure if we got that, or did we?
I mean, I think we're close. I mean, certainly, we actually kind of did some of the comp studies before some of the other localities. So probably by the time ours is implemented, everyone else kind of had theirs. I mean, a lot of localities did theirs soon thereafter. But I mean, I think we're competitive now, which is
the biggest thing. I want to make sure that we stay competitive because the last thing we want is somebody to win the election and walk in here and go, sorry, that's not high. Hold us up for a barrel.
No, they won't be holding us up for a barrel.
Okay, we say no, that's going to be it, and they walk away.
So it's their choice. I mean, they just spent the money right for the election.
Yeah, then we have no treasurer while we're in the election cycle, or no commissioner of the revenue, or whichever position it might be.
I mean, again, if you're running for the office and you don't understand the policy, and then you get in and you resign, well, in my opinion, you're not the right person for that office. Right.
I totally understand what you're saying, but I just...
Yeah, that's true.
So just to be clear, A, from what I'm hearing, is the majority of the board saying A is fine as it is?
Yeah.
Even the part of the board may consider education experience, special skills, or certifications and proficiency, and relate, that's very vague.
I think it's allowing us wiggle room.
Oh, it's so much flexibility.
I mean, we couldn't direct that they would consider those things. You can't tell one board can't tell the next that they will consider those things.
No, I mean, correct. It's going to be up to the next board to determine what that is. I mean, there is some interpretation and there's some latitude within there. Again, from like my standpoint, you know, we use kind of a similar model, education, experience, and special skills, 5%, 5%, 5%, to kind of determine what individuals may come into the county based upon some of those criteria. So I think when the board adopted this before, it was kind of based upon that same model a little bit. But so I think I hear A is fine. Come back with some changes about B, and do you want me to add something about the board may consider a higher amount than there, should that special circumstance come up?
Yeah, me too. It can be that vague.
Okay. Okay. Like I said, no decision points, no action. Just wanted to get some direction to come back with something more formally to the board.
Okay, thank you. Yep. All right, now we'll have a treat with the county fair update. Aaron?
Oh, he doesn't have like questions or anything at the end, you know, so you kind of know. How you doing? Good evening. How are y'all doing this evening? So I'm here to give the 2023 Sylvania County Fair Review. And I have with me Kirsten Kropp. She's the Vice President of the Fair Board. So if there's any questions, she can help too. Huh? She's probably got more than I do. I'm not going to lie.
So just let me know. Next slide.
Next slide. So that was the rodeo. Everybody saw it, I think, on the last time I presented a couple pictures, like how many people. So our attendance this year, there was 7,262 paying people over the 3 days. We estimated 9,000 plus people being there. With vendors, because your vendors, you got two or three people at every vendors, and kids coming in that we don't charge under three, and all that, so we had a lot. We had 5,336 people just on Saturday alone, so it was a big day.
Yeah.
So parks and rec expenses, we had to expend a little more, I think, in the contract services with the light towers. We had to get more light towers in the past. So we had 30 this year. In the past, we've had about 25, so. I think that allows us to light the park up a lot better all the way from the front to the back.
And two, if you saw all the people, I mean, those fields, I mean, again, we parked, Aaron parked on both sides of the fields, and that is...
We might have to get another one or two because we're going to have to move parking up kind of behind 4-H, I think, in that little parking area. And then we have the school, so we're probably going to have to look into another couple of light towers for next year. So it's just an expense we have because it's dark. You know, so we have to light it up for safety.
You got extra lights over there now to help.
It does not. Those lights go straight down, so they don't project out.
A little bit,
but they don't project out. They were asking if we could use them for the rodeo field, put some lights on the tops of the back so we could shine them on the other field, and that would save us some money to have to rent lights in the future if we ever do stuff in that field. So it's a way, and we have that capability of doing that kind of stuff with those lights. Just for the future. So our expenses were $27,749.96. The Parks and Rec revenues, that's the gate sales, the carnival ride sales, and the vendor sales, and the carnival rides were up, I think, $15,000 more than we've ever done, which is awesome. He was really happy, the guy, the Valley Amusements that runs it. They were really happy. So our revenue was $45,915.50. And then we go to the fair board's expenses. So their expenses this year, they had the Axmo Domain, which is a new expense that they had, and the Bar C, right? Petting Zoo? Bar C Ranch. Bar C Ranch Petting Zoo. So those are two new expenses, and that was plus the Works Band. They cost a little bit more than we normally pay for a band. So between those three, their expenses were up a little bit more. And we got, what are those things? Bleachers for the rodeo. So I think that was about $5,000 for the bleachers maybe. So that's an expense. Plus they pay for parking on professional parking on Friday and Saturday that we've never done before. So those were some expenses that the fair boards incurs that the county does not. So their expenses were $63,594.89. So their revenues were their sponsors, so they get all the sponsor revenue, but the county doesn't. We get the vendors. The gate sales, they get two of the $5. to help them for the next year. And they get all their activities, the rodeo, they try to recoup their money. I think we did recoup all our money for the rodeo this year. The Virginia Jack did about what it did last year for 2 days, so it might only be a 1 day thing we want to look at. So, but their revenues were $78,820. So the next page kind of breaks it down year by year. I kind of let you kind of know what the county did. I don't really keep the fair boards more than a year, but if you had questions, I could let you know what they are.
And when you see the word balance, that's just kind of like the net profit.
It's not, yeah, it's what we would turn in to the county, and it goes into the general fund. That's our balance.
Expenses. Yes.
That's everything. That's our revenue expenses, $18,165.54.
Yeah, so
was what the county made, I guess, yeah, off the county fair. And then $15,225.11 is what the fair board made off the county fair.
So like for the counties, for instance, the balance every year, like the, you know, starting back at 2017, 2018, 2019, that money just kind of goes back into the general fund. But, you know, for the fair boards, again, since there's kind of separate expenditures and separate revenues, whatever the fair board makes, that stays with the fair board. And
they're a 501.
Yeah, they're a 501c3, I believe. And,
yep.
And so for certainly, you know, if there's a year that there's, knock on wood, that we don't have it rain or something like that, you know, they've got a lot of exposure out there too for some of these vendors, well, and events.
They take the hit if we don't have the rodeo. It's $16,000, I think, or something like that. At least $16,000 that they're out because it rains us out, but they're set up. So that's an expense that the fair board is taking on, that the county is not the risk that the fair board. That's why they get all the sponsorships and stuff. And SNN and AMP, they've been great sponsors for us the past years. They gave us, I think it's $25,000 the past 2 years to help out. Not mentioning the other sponsors that we have, I'll mention them. But you know what I'm saying? That helps us a lot to be able to do some of the stuff we're doing. Any questions until the next page?
The 2023 balance, that's the net from this year.
Yep.
Yes.
And then you're carrying on to the 2024.
Nope.
Balance?
I start new.
Oh, you start
new. Yeah. So I budget.
For the fair board, I imagine.
They will start. They will add that to whatever their kitty, whatever they had that they didn't spend.
Yeah.
I don't know. Whatever they didn't spend out of their budget, they'll add the 15 to that to be able to use for next year.
Yeah, every year on the county side, whatever that balances or net profit, that just kind of goes back to the general.
It goes to the general. It does not go to Parks and Rec at all. So.
So what happened in 22? From 17 through 21 is all single digit, you know, 7, 8, 9,000. Then 1 year it more than doubled.
That's when we went to $5 for gate sales instead of $2 or $3.
That's also the first year that we were getting SNA.
Yeah, we've also got, yeah, they were. That's where we could start getting bigger stuff, like the Virginia Jack was our big thing last year, and the rodeo. And a couple of things. I mean, we were able to start building the fair more than we're able to in the past.
Yeah, so if you think about it, it's a little combination. So you got a little higher gate ticket to get in, and then to get into the fair, then there's more more vendors, more events, more things to do, more things to see, so it's drawing more people in.
Yeah, I think I had the vendors. We had 60, we had, I think it was like 65 non-food vendors and 20 food vendors this year, which is 80 vendors. That's a lot. Most we've ever had is really 40, 45.
What was your old ticket price?
$3, I think. The county took two and the fair board got one. I think is
so
what...
$7,500 right there.
Yeah, I think that was the deal. That was our old deal right there. And I think we changed it 2 years ago because you know how hard it is to get people to... Like, if they give you 100 for one person for $3, they get us all of our money.
Well,
so it's a little bit easier.
Just when you go in, when you're looking at what other fairs,
we're cheaper than,
yeah,
we're still cheaper than the fairs.
We're also charging for events where they're not charging for events.
Yeah.
We charge separate.
And the real impressive part is your area where the children can play. I mean, it's all free.
It's all free. So, the county takes on that in the budget.
Yeah, and I was really impressed with
most of it.
Individual fans on the animals. The big bulls, they had fans on them to keep them cool.
Yeah.
I thought that was neat. I mean, and it, you know, you don't have no big odors. It's clean. And
this year was the first year we used the pole barn for the petting zoo. It used to be a tent, but we had a bigger petting zoo. Yeah. So they spent, I think, more money on the petting zoo this year than they have. The maximum, I think, was like $7,500. So that's a big expense that we haven't used in the past. So that's some of it.
When you went from 21 to 22, with that increase in the gate fee, did it do anything to, like, do you know what numbers did as far as how many people, how many tickets sold?
It was probably about the same. Maybe I have to look for that. I can let you know. Because I have it on there. It's on the first sheet. I have how many people are paying every year. So that's something I can give you easy.
Okay.
I just don't have it on me today.
That's good. Thank you.
But I can tell you, that's the year we started going down 53 more than in the past. I think that's when we went to the third telephone pole down 53. The first year we ever did that. Most of our years were in the middle. Huh? Yeah, right. So we're just growing. And then some of the places around here don't have some fairs like they used to, so we're getting some of those people.
That was one thing I heard too.
A couple of different things. People are looking for stuff to do. So we're getting a lot. And the rodeo brings a big crowd. And the axe women, I think, brought a pretty good crowd every day. And then we had the main lobster food truck that may could have brought some people out Friday just to come get the food truck, because it was on the Shark Tank, the food truck that was on the Shark Tank. So we had new stuff that we've never really had in the past couple of years. We're trying to make it an awesome place, which it is, but we're trying to keep building on it every year. It costs money, everything goes up, but I can get you the last three. I can just put it on a zip drive.
Thank you.
Yep. Next, we had a special needs event out there on Fridays from 10 to 12, and we allow any special needs person in the community to come out, whether it's a kid, a veteran, just a citizen, anybody. Most of them, I think, are students this year. I don't know if we had any nursing homes. We did it 1 year ago or 2 years ago, but we didn't have any this year. So we had about 60, I would say. The Valley Amusements, they open up all the rides. They open up a couple games. They give kids prizes for free. They don't ask for them to pay anything. It's all free. The Axe Women put on a sensory show that was, I forget, it's like a, you know, like a sensory.
It doesn't involve chainsaws.
Yes, yeah, so it doesn't involve chainsaws, stuff like that. For them, which is nice, so that way all the kids could kind of walk, look around and see. And then the Barcy Ranch Petting Zoo, they opened up the petting zoo, so the special needs kids could actually go in there, because it's closed during the day. E.W. Thomas and SNN, they provided meals for the participants and staff. There were pizza, chicken nuggets, french fries, all that kind of stuff on site. And then a special thanks to Wade Parish, Valley Amusements, SNN, the public schools for helping, Parks and Rec, and the Fair Board. We all kind of worked on this together, so it's a good community event.
Yeah, when you're
and the parents really love it.
And when you're out there, when you see Parks and Rec and the Fair Board, you can you can tell they're working. They're
you have it down pat.
It's taking a while to figure it out. So we have a new sign that we're going to use next year for parking. We got a new electronic message board sign that just came in while the fair was going on, so we haven't had time to use it, so we're going to start using some of that.
Very good.
This is just an idea, how you say this one. But if you're parking all the way down to the third pole up on 53, could you use the soccer parking?
Too far. Well, so on Saturday we can't let anybody pass the cul-de-sac because of the rodeo.
Draw the rodeo. Oh. Yeah.
So we have the rodeo.
I knew there would be a reason.
That's why we don't. Myself. Yeah, we kind of shut it down. That's about 5 o'clock. We don't even let people go back towards the soccer fields or the ball fields to practice that day.
Okay. So they still can go back there and do that
until Saturday, usually until the rodeo. And I think the monster truck. It was new with their contract. They didn't want anybody back there. Because of, you know, the truck could go over the field and hit somebody or something. So we kind of, they could do. So so we had to limit, we kind of have to limit a little bit of that, who can go back there at certain times. We try to leave it as open as we can for people to go use that part of the park. So our home arts, Erica Mitchell and Susan Eddington, they did up our home arts this year. It was very difficult for them to secure volunteers and judges. And I think that's happening everywhere for a lot of things these days. It's just hard to get people to come out. I don't know if Erica's gonna come back. She's the owner of Sweetheart Emporium. It took a lot from her business to help with the fair, as it does for all of our fair board volunteers, you know? So some of them have a little more time than others. But it was very successful. We had 150 entries. 38 volunteers, and they increased the categories from last year. So that's always a plus. And I think we had 3 sheds this year instead of 2. So we were able to spread our stuff out to make more room for more stuff. The next one, I think, is our fair board. Without our fair board, we can't have this. So I have to make sure that everybody, Wayne Parrish, Kirsten Kropp, Rachel Crenshaw, Shannon Snoddy, Erica Mitchell and Susan Eddington, Kim Mayo, George and Gene Gowen, and my staff, Brendan Cripp, they get the thanks that they need because it's a year-long process. They've already started meeting for next year's fair. So, and also the fire and rescue, we had a couple bee stings. It took a day to find a beehive, but I finally found it, so we were able to not have people stung out there. It's near the stage. Of course, stuff happens, right? And then the Sheriff's Department, State Police, for really helping us get traffic off of 53 on into the park, especially on Saturday. Because we actually came into school. Actually, I came in twice, 2 ways into the park to try to alleviate traffic on 53 that day. And all the volunteers to help out throughout the fair. We appreciate all their help. We have some pictures. And that's all I have. Any questions?
Fun fact, the 1893 World's Fair, that's when Pabst won the blue ribbon, so
awesome. But we thank you for your support and funding, you know, helping fund the fair. Without the fair board throwing in the budget, we couldn't have it. So we appreciate it. And I'll try to let you know how many people we've had for like the past 3 years.
Cool.
Is that good?
Good. Wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Do you have anything for Ms. Kropp? No?
It's great job.
Yeah.
Oh,
she right. has a strong back. She's got to take that president around there.
She does a lot. She was our sponsor and our media, and she did more tasks than just the vice president this past year. So
thank you.
She does a lot.
Thank you.
Thank y'all.
So yeah, I'm going to do a quick presentation, then I'm going to hand it over to Mr. Witten, and he's going to kind of go into some more of the legal things. Oops, I didn't mean to hit that document. Let me go back here. So again, so the topic's called short-term rental ordinance, which one we don't have. We don't have a short-term rental ordinance right now. It's currently, Flavetta County permits the rental of rooms to tourists as part of our home occupation zoning ordinance definition. So the home occupation definition is summarized as an accessory use of a dwelling unit or an accessory structure for gainful employment involving the production, provision, or sale of goods and or services, which is clearly incidental to or secondary to the residential use of the parcel. And so just kind of looking at home occupations as it pertains to this, home occupation shall include the rental of rooms to tourists. Home occupations must be conducted in accordance with all applicable federal, state,
local statutes and regulatory requirements. So basically, the maximum floor area permitted for a home occupation shall be 25% of the finished floor area of the dwelling unit. And so kind of general standards included as an enclosure, which limits home occupation to 25% of the home. So as it stands right now, you know, you have to be in your home. You can't technically, and I have that here. So currently a short-term rental of an entire house is not permitted. However, a property owner could rent out one room of their home provided that a member of the household is on the premises. And the rental of the rooms was mainly intended to provide short-term stays of visiting tourists. And then again, a homeowners association that does not permit short-term rentals in their covenants, if they don't allow it, then it wouldn't be allowed. Again, those covenants of the HOA take precedence over what the county does. So right now, we had a discussion, and this was probably maybe about a year ago, that there was some discussion about some short-term rentals in the county, and that going on Airbnb, that there are some that are currently not in accordance with what is allowed currently by the home occupation. And so the board wanted to come back and kind of look at that a little bit more. At the time, the board didn't want to push forward with any enforcement until we had this discussion and kind of bring this back. So here we are, and so that's kind of the first piece, and then I'm gonna hand it over to Mr. Witten, and he's gonna kind of talk a little bit more, you know, what it would, some of the legal provisions of having a short-term rental ordinance. So, Mr. Witten, just let me know when you want to go to the next slide.
So, a few weeks ago, I was attending a lunch and learn with local government attorneys, and it was the town attorney for the town of Irvington on the Northern Neck, and then a city attorney in Virginia Beach. They went over short-term rental ordinances and stamp ordinances. So I was talking to Mr. Dahl, he had a good presentation to do to the board. Kind of giving a legal overview and then a few examples of sample ordinances. So state code definition of short-term rental is the provision of room or space suitable or intended for dwelling, sleeping, or lodging purposes for a period of fewer than 30 days in exchange for a charge. So after 30 days, it's a long-term rental, month-to-month rental. So we all know the platforms Airbnb, VRBO, HomeAway, where you book your rental at a beach or mountainous area or here in Fluvanna County. So it's difficult to tell from the outside that it's a short-term rental. Usually there's not any signage, and you wouldn't know otherwise that it's a short-term rental. So the Virginia Code has been amended in the past couple of years to help regulate the collection of transient occupancy taxes through those platforms. So real quick, I'll go into transient occupancy tax. That'll be at our next meeting. We'll go in more depth and have a public hearing. But section 58.1-3819 does authorize the transient occupancy tax. Right now, it's easy for hosts on Airbnb to basically avoid the sales and transient tax. And if the tax ordinance was adopted at the next meeting, then the accommodations intermediaries would have to provide a list of rentals and gross receipts to the locality. So we would know all the Airbnb rentals, all the VRBO rentals in the county. And then the intermediary would also collect and remit the transient tax to the locality. So there was a study commission a couple years ago that recommended the local ordinances be uniform for accommodations intermediaries. So last year and this year, a lot of localities across the state amended their transient tax ordinances to be more uniform, and the rates were also posted with the Department of Taxation to make it easier for Airbnb. And some localities also entered into voluntary collection agreements with the intermediaries. I believe Alexandria did that, but that's not been across the board. That was just an option a few localities did. So the other authority under the state code is Virginia Code 15.2983. which came out in 2017, I believe, and authorized annual registration administered by county employees. So based on under the registration, the county can assess a reasonable fee and levy a $500 penalty for violation if you don't register. Then the county can prohibit the rental of a unit that's not registered, and the county can also prohibit rentals where there's multiple violations at that property. So the other option is regulating the rental through land use and zoning authority, which is the more typical platform. So now going back to the registration ordinance, there was an exemption in that ordinance that it did not apply to realtors or vendors represented by someone who has a license, real estate license. Also under timeshares, it does not apply to timeshares. It also doesn't apply to campgrounds, motels. So really the registration ordinance is geared more just to Airbnb, VRBO, or someone renting it individually. The registration ordinance, you see a few across the state, but it wasn't across the board changed like I think they thought it would happen in 2017. And still the ordinance would not supersede the declarations of property owners associations, such as Lake Monticello, where short-term rentals are prohibited. So the other option is regulating it through zoning. So the first sample ordinance I came across was Albemarle County. And basically, it does require building official, fire official, and health department approval. And all these requirements are in their supplemental regulation section. It also requires a safety inspection, notice to all the adjacent neighbors. You have to have off-street parking. They call it homestays instead of short-term rentals, but it has to be in residential and rural area districts. And so actually, it's by right in agricultural districts. So this doesn't apply to agricultural. This is just residential and rural area. And you can rent two rooms when it's less than 5 acres, or five rooms with a special exception. They have a strange provision where the whole house rental is 7 days a month or 45 days a year, which would be really hard on the zoning department to regulate. You really just have to depend on the gross receipts you're receiving from Airbnb to regulate that. So I think that'd be pretty hard with a small department to regulate the exact number of days in talking to Douglas. So accessory structures can be used with a special exception, like your garage or barn that you've converted. And the homeowners have to reside 180 days per year in the house, which I think is a good idea, so they're not just buying the house as an investment, not living in D.C. or somewhere else. The board can authorize by special exception the residency of a property manager to live in the house. And if they don't have that, the homeowners must have the contact for an agent who lives within 30 miles and must be able to respond within an hour. So a totally different way of handling it is Virginia Beach, where they actually have short-term rental overlay districts. And so when the Virginia Beach attorney talked about, basically this was like a five-year effort of groups coming together trying to come up with a compromise, and they came up with these overlay districts. And so they treated short-term rentals different from home sharing. What we have here is more home sharing where you're renting a room. And so the short-term rental there does require a zoning permit. Home sharing does require a zoning permit. You just register with the commissioner to transient tax. The rentals are limited to the overlay districts, but they did grandfather the existing rentals because prior to that they had a CUP process throughout the whole city. So they grandfathered the existing rentals. You can't use accessory structures, no more than two contracts in a 7-day period. And in a similar fashion, you have to have a responsible party within 30 minutes, $1 million in liability insurance, no more than three persons per bedroom, and a life safety and structural safety inspection report is required. So life safety is saying you have your fire extinguisher, carbon monoxide, and then it's safety inspection. It makes sense, especially Virginia Beach when you have all those decks, high decks, and being close to the ocean. That makes sense. So the next ordinance is the one I worked on way back in 2012. Back then, short-term rentals were kind of a new thing. So I can kind of talk about like the issues they've had with the ordinance 11 years later. So basically, the conditional use permit is required, and it's reviewed on an annual basis by staff. They did require 100-foot setback from other residences, but that can be waived by the board. And originally, they allowed it by right in ag districts if it was over 5 acres. But then in 2014, they changed it to requiring a CUP, conditional use permit, for all short-term rentals. So there was no requirement there that an owner lives in the house part of the year. So what's happening, if you look at their agendas, every board meeting, each month, they have 5-6 public hearings for short-term rentals. So they have over 100 short-term rentals now in a county that's 40,000 people. It's not that large. And so what's happened is all these people from outside the county have invested in the county, fixed up houses, and then turned into a short-term rental. Maximum occupants is determined by the health department, number of bedrooms, but it can never exceed 10. No off-street parking. You have to mark property boundaries. No signage is allowed. You have to have life safety measures there. The county can inspect with 24-hour notice, and the property management plan has to be posted inside the rental, including the emergency evacuation plan. So kind of summary, we can talk about whether only homeowners can host a short-term rental. I don't think you want renters hosting a short-term rental if you have like a long-term tenant in your house. Also, whether short-term rentals should only be allowed at primary residence rather than a secondary residence. Limiting the frequency of rentals. Parking requirement, whether we require a conditional special use permit. Limiting the number of guests, and then the life safety requirement. So there is enforcement. There was one occasion in Warren County where someone, after the board denied the conditional use permit, and it was appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, the person still operated it, so I had filed an injunction to shut down the use because criminal penalties weren't working. So I filed an injunction and went to Circuit Court. So you have civil penalty option, criminal penalties, injunctions, denial of the zoning permits, CEP, SUP permits, and also just together using all the regulations of the registry ordinance, zoning ordinance, and your transient occupancy tax to regulate it. So grandfathering, we'd have to have specific language in our ordinance that says if you currently have a short-term rental in the county, then you can continue to operate it without a special use permit. So that would be a decision of the board if they want to allow specific grandfathered language. But the uses in the county right now would not fall under the not conforming but legal, because right now the use has never been allowed, so they wouldn't have that non-conforming use that, okay, well, it used to be allowed. So they'd have to show that, it came into effect before the zoning ordinance went into effect. We've been operating this since the 60s, which would be a hard, it burns on them, on the owner to prove that it's non-conforming. So I don't think we would have that argument, but I did put the language in there to show if it's non-conforming use, it's still legal. So other potential regulations under our zone, our county code, would be light pollution, our lighting ordinance, our noise ordinance, VDOT and traffic enforcement controls, and then you still have the ADA and building code regulations. So an interesting Attorney General opinion came out earlier this year in January, actually out of Cumberland County, and the county attorney asked the question. And basically, what is agritourism and how does that relate to short-term rentals? So agritourism, a definition from the state code, is basically any activity carried out on a farm for members of the general public, including farming, wineries. So we have two wineries in the county, so those would be considered agritourism activities because they're located in agricultural zoned areas. So under section 15.2, 2288.6, it says no locality can regulate any of the following activities, including agritourism activities. So the question was, when you have, again, next slide, when you have a short-term rental at one of these wineries or farm breweries, farm cideries, can the county require a SUP or a CUP? And the Attorney General said basically that under the defined circumstances, the situation, I guess, in Cumberland, that basically the county could not regulate it. But he did say it was very fact specific, and you have to look at whether it's agriculturally zoned district and it's whether it's an agricultural operation. So it can't just be a house, single family house located.
House
located
on 10 acres in A1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you got a beehive there.
Yeah, so you have to have some activity where the general public can come. So there's the little farm market that sells the peaches and apples off the street on 53. So basically something like that, they had a short-term rental. Because that's something open to the public, but it's agricultural activity. So that was an interesting opinion. I mean, basically, attorney general opinions are not binding authority. It's more for persuasive authority. But it's nothing that binds the county to say you can't, you no longer do that. But it's just something to consider as we draft an ordinance and whether we consider making it by right or by SUP in agriculturally zoned districts and basically the intertwining of agritourism. So were there any questions after the presentation?
Yeah, that was a lot of information, but I mean I think we're at the point where, you know, we don't have a short-term rental ordinance, but we have a way for individuals through the home occupation to rent out their property. We know for certain right now that there are individuals on Airbnb and those that are not in compliance with the way that the county currently has its ordinance for someone to do that. So I guess the question of the board is, does the board want staff to draft more of a short-term rental ordinance? And then maybe if we could get some direction on you know, how do we want it? Do we want it more restrictive, less restrictive? Do we want, you know, do we want the owners to be on property? Do we want it to be wide open and let people do what they want? And so those are some of the things that Dan was talking about. And again, you know, what we bring back, you know, this could be a couple iterations of some ordinances if the board wants to implement something to allow more short-term rentals in the county.
My inclination would be less restrictive, and I mean, let's let people, you know, they're going through the effort and the expense and so on of doing this with their home. Let's not get too much into their stuff. And but at the same time, you know, we're initiating some participation in these financial events.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at some of the examples that look good. I think it really depends on localities. And as far as I'm aware of, the only time this has really come to the board's attention was because we were enforcing the homeowners code that we have versus because there's been other neighbors and or people complaining about short-term rentals or affecting them. But I don't know that it's been a maybe planning or zoning has had some other instances. But as far as I know, we've seen a lot of homeowners complain about the process.
No, I don't think we've been getting necessarily complaints. It's just there are rentals that are not meeting what is allowable right now.
I totally understand that. Yeah.
We weren't
going to enforce it because we were being arbitrary, right, at that point in time.
So the question is, do we get something a little more robust that allows it? And then if we do that, what does that look like?
I think an ordinance is, as Mr. Fairchild said, not terribly restrictive, but at least specify certain safety, such as fire plans and things like that, seem common sense. But whether the homeowner's there or not, those are question marks, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Would you want to require a special use permit? Or would you want to have that by right?
Would you want
to? You do it by right now. You know, yeah. It starts becoming a problem. Mm-hmm. Do that, but it's just.
Would you want to do the registration ordinance?
Yes.
And the zoning department would then know what rentals are rented through Airbnb or VRBO. It would still be by right, and they have a small fee that I can talk to them, so would that be based on staff time?
Right. Does Lake Monticello still have a ban on these?
Yeah, I mean, that's it.
Yeah,
the homeowners association said that was banned.
Yeah, there was a state Supreme Court case in like 2005 in Smith Mountain Lake, and they said, basically the case said you have to specifically say short-term rentals in your restricted covenants. You can't just say no business uses, because that's what Smith Mountain Lake HOA just said, no business uses. And the case that went to the Supreme Court said, well, a short-term rental is a residential use. So you have to specifically say no short-term rentals in your So a lot of HOAs changed their restricted covenants after that point, if they're one already in there.
So we have 40-some% of our homes that are disqualified from it anyway.
Right.
That's not really something that we need to create a whole lot of pomp and circumstance over.
No, I mean, I think the one thing is, you know, there are certainly some people that are doing it right now, and you know, the good thing is most likely that's bringing people from outside of the area into the county where we don't have any hotels or any other
lodging establishments currently. So, you know, the way I see it is that's bringing some revenue. Again, if the board approves the transient occupancy tax, you know, if that just kind of helps to, you know, people coming in here. Again, we're not necessarily taxing those that are here. It's visitors for the most part, and so
it's being collected by the intermediary.
Correct.
Pretty low, you know, pretty low management in terms of taking care of it. Maybe that county collects another $50,000 or who knows what.
Yeah, I think initially it'll be low, but maybe if we open up the ordinance a little bit, where those that see that, you know, maybe it's not so restrictive. Maybe like someone will say, well, you know, maybe I do want to do this, or maybe, you know, kind of expand on what they're already doing.
If I remember correctly, it was brought to our attention because somebody built a treehouse.
Right.
It was.
Nice treehouse.
Very nice.
Right now, that one's on Airbnb.
Yes.
You can rent that by the night, 200 a night.
Yeah, I mean, like, for instance, I was looking, there's a whole house right on 15 somewhere for rent. And, I mean, so again, it's happening in the county. It's just
treehouse was brought up, Mr. Witten's knowledge was because they'd kind of gone through zoning. They said, what do we need to do? They did all that. And they put it on. They said, well, you're not allowed to do that.
Well, it was said originally that this can't be used for that. And then after it was seen on Airbnb.
Gotcha.
So the ordinance was passed then, what probably would allow for more people to rent out their houses, or maybe invest in the county and fix up houses and rent into short-term rentals.
Well, think about it with the wineries around us, people looking to do that, because you're close enough here to day trips, because as many of them as you want.
Mm-hmm. There's a reset happening in the Airbnb market anyhow right now. It's, a lot of the fees have gotten a little out of hand, cleaning fees and so on.
Yeah.
Like, really, you don't want to do that, you don't want to go to a hotel. Unless you have to maintain a certain limit, you have to keep a certain star rating in order to advertise.
Okay, so we are clear on what
yeah.
I'll draft an ordinance and bring it back for discussion. Depending on the schedule.
We'll take a look at kind of what's coming up and get a draft back before the board. Nothing for maybe approval, but an initial kind of first look at what an ordinance would look like.
And then we'll give it to offer to the planning commission and the board to say,
yeah,
okay, the language.
All right, thank you. We have a consent agenda that I don't believe. We only have two items. Have you ever?
Really nice.
This is nice. Minutes of September 2023 and HFY24 additional library state aid supplementary appropriation.
Move we adopt the consent agenda.
All right. We have a motion.
I got 2 seconds.
With 2 seconds. Ms. Avery and Mr. O'Brien. Now, Mrs. Eager, she has to be there. Did you get that?
I'm sorry, repeat.
People? Did you get the person who seconded?
I thought it was Mr. O'Brien.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
We'll fight over it.
Okay. He's the first one I heard. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Any unfinished business? Anyone?
We got
a vote. Oh, and
consent. Oh, yeah. That's right. Okay.
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All opposed. And then
I can't
move.
I
can't
move.
Okay. All right, now do we have any unfinished business? If not, we do have some new businesses here.
Yeah, so a couple things. One, JRWA special use permit fee waiver. So let me open up just kind of the staff report on a presentation. But back when the James River Water Authority submitted a special use application back in 2015, the county at that time waived the fees for the James River Water Authority. Again, it's a 50-50 partnership between Fluvanna and Louisa County, so we're basically waiving our fees for ourselves. But, you know, there is some contribution by Louisa County. Back then, it was actually more expensive to do it because we were doing a lot of the notifications all by certified mail, so it got pretty pricey. There's been some changes since then where we've been doing those not by certified mail. You can do them by regular mail or what's it called?
Well, not registered.
Yeah, just registered regular mail. So the cost is significantly less than what it is. So right now, the special use permit application fee is $800. We had talked about doing just notification signs, 5 public hearing signs kind of along the route. So 5 signs, you know, a couple signs on Bremo Road and a couple signs on Route 6 between Bremo Road going towards Columbia, kind of where the interconnect is, and then you've got some mailing. So the total cost would be $1,341. So we're requesting for the board to approve a waiver of fees for the James River Water Authority associated with the submission of the SUP.
All right, any questions, comments?
And why waiver again?
What's that?
Why waive the fees?
Because we pay 50%.
We pay 50% of the fees.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
fees.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, we can charge the fee. Yeah.
Okay. Do we? That's
not. I move board supervisors waive $1,341 in fees associated with the submission of a special use permit application for James River Water Project, including special use permit fee $800, public hearing sign deposit $450, and adjoining property owner notifications $91.
Okay. Do we have a second? Did I hear a second? All right. Motion was made by Mr. Sheridan, second by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Anyone opposed? Chair votes aye.
The second one we just want to bring up is just with some of the little instances we've had with Zoom meetings as of late and some of the surprises we're getting. You know, we want to bring up a discussion, Ms. Harris and Mr. Witt and myself, kind of talking about Zoom meetings and what we should and should not allow. And you know, the discussion came up, should we continue to allow the Zoom meeting participation function that we're doing right now? I mean, again, certainly, you know, we live stream all the meetings, and so there's always the opportunity to see the meeting live. But with some of the issues that we've been having with kind of getting bombed, we'll say.
So an individual, a citizen would not be able to participate,
correct,
like in public comment?
Correct. They would not be able to participate via Zoom in public comment. And so the one thing, you know, we kind of implemented this whole Zoom function as of COVID, you know, to kind of allow greater participation and allow people that are, that maybe, you know, don't want to be around other people to engage in board meetings. Now, I mean, you know, we get some participation remotely, but it's not grand. It's not like you're getting, you know, 30 people out participating in a Zoom meeting. And Dan, do you want to chime in on some of the legal components of it?
Well, I'd say, like, Charlottesville had a similar issue in their last meeting. Someone in their Zoom meeting used the N-word 14 times. And so they're running into the same issues on this LGA listserv about basically when you have obscenity, like we have, that's outside the First Amendment, we have, you know, fighting words and saying violence, like Charlottesville had, that's not allowed. So you just have to make sure you have a very strict policy, which we have a good policy, but we have, you know, enforcing it, and, you know, if someone's in the middle of, we really haven't had a verbal tirade, but basically when do you, you know, make them leave the meeting and tell them that's enough without violating the First Amendment. And so Zoom is not required under the Freedom of Information Act. You know, we do have audio recording and a video recording through YouTube. So it's not a required component. One thing we discussed was, well, do we allow just staff to use Zoom and not allow the public? And so I think that would overcome any legal challenges, just because it's just for staff to answer questions. It's not, you know, it's not for staff to weigh in at public comment time or public hearing time.
So you're saying only staff would be able to participate,
yes,
but still citizens would be able to watch?
Yes.
They'd be able to watch on YouTube, but they wouldn't be able to watch on, like, the Zoom link would just be for staff.
Yeah.
To utilize. So that was one compromise we thought of, just because, like, the other night when we asked a question of Michael Grandstaff. And normally he wouldn't have been at the meeting, but he was on Zoom, so we're able to ask the question. So there is a benefit to that.
There's a benefit to having it available to those that we know that we know are participating. But, you know,
it's a child's trouble if they do something like that.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, we've had these two instances, and it's getting me a little challenging a little bit, and at what point do we draw the line? And so just wanted to bring the discussion up to the board and what the legal components are. I mean, again, if we had a pretty robust participation, well, then maybe we didn't get rid of it. But I mean, participation remotely has been fairly low. I mean, again, you can still see it. The only difference is you can still live stream it on YouTube and see what's going on. It would just not allow the public comment, whether it's a public hearing or public comment. So that would be the elimination piece.
I don't feel like, as you said, we don't have a lot of citizens chiming in via Zoom. And so it's not going to affect hardly any. And if they knew they couldn't, there's a good chance they'd come here to express themselves. Now, I would just wonder if there's some way we can put some sort of pop-up that says, like, that you can no longer participate via Zoom in public comment or something like that, to where they're not on there thinking they're going to get to and can't.
We could put that language in the public hearing advertisements, you know, for the short term, public hearings. We just say, if you'd like to comment, please, you know, email or mail your comments or comment in person. And we are no longer offering Zoom as an option to submit your comments.
As we get somebody who wants to comment.
I just wonder if there's, you're saying just put that in the, you said put that where?
The public hearing ad, because of the banner.
Yeah. So, of course, the average person is not reading public.
I mean, we can also have it on the website, too. The ad is on the website.
That's just an ask, okay.
And
yeah.
We put it on Facebook as well.
Yeah, I mean, we could put it out in fan mail. I mean, we could start to get the word out for people to understand and know that they can't make comments via Zoom anymore.
One way to maybe go about it is, if you do wish to make a public comment through Zoom, that you would have to previously notify or whatever via email, send your group to do so. I mean, that would be one way. So that we don't have some random person. Because the problem is, okay, we have public comments, we have some ding dong out there who wants to, well, we have to
photobomb. Probably not the best word to use.
Sorry. They raise their hand, and then the minute they raise their hand, you get that nonsense.
And some localities do that, where you have to pre-register in advance for public, especially bigger localities, right? A lot of people want to speak. So, I mean, if you see that for the in-person, I don't know if I've seen that on the Zoom.
Yeah.
Definitely in-person.
I'm just trying to think for the pre-registration. I mean, even if someone was, I guess it would disallow someone on the spur of the moment thinking, hey, I want to go do this. I actually have to think about it a little bit more in advance if I want to. Because, I mean, again, if someone wanted to do something a little mischievous, they could reach out to Ms. Solise and say, I want to make public comments. And then, okay, well, you're registered. And then we have you around there for public comments. And then stuff pops up.
That's just
more to do. That's just
something
else to keep up with.
And like I said, if we had earth-shattering participation, that would be one thing. But again, we're still allowing people to see it remotely and live stream. It would just allow public comment.
I agree.
Yeah.
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 What is it? Is that we have a majority on that? Okay.
Right.
All right. So what we will do? We will start pushing the word out in public hearings, fan mail, website, all that stuff, informing the public that that's the route that.
Now we're ready for the second public comments. Anyone who would like to speak to the board, please come to the lectern and give your name and address and talk to the board. Anyone? Okay. Good evening.
Hello. My name is James Chonster. I live at 843 Jefferson Drive, Palmyra. Just because of this conversation y'all literally just had, I just want to advocate for trying to find a way for public comment via Zoom, whether that be registering in some fashion, just to advocate for working families and folks who may not be able to make it to a public comment section at 5:10 in the afternoon or evening. The Zoom option does give a little bit of flexibility to hear the people of the county who might not be available for making it to the meeting in person. That's all.
Thank you. Anyone else?
We don't usually do this, but that is the good part about having two rounds of public comment. So if they can't get here at 5:10, they can come at 8:10 or 10:10 or 11:10.
All right, anyone else would like to speak to the board?
I really want to speak.
Okay, if not, I'm closing this section.
I was going to say, if they want to do it over Zoom, do it now.
Okay. Closed meeting, Mr. O'Brien.
Madam Chair, I move the Savannah County Board of Supervisors enter into a closed meeting pursuant to the provisions of Section 2.2-3711A1 and Section 2.2-3711A5 of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended for the purpose of discussing personnel and attorney's performance and prospective industry, prospective business update.
Okay, can we have a second? All right, we have a motion by Mr. O'Brien to go into closed session and a second by Mrs. Eager. All in favor?
Aye.
I know no one's going to oppose. Chair votes aye, so we are now in closed session.
I just love these.
So I'm muted.
Yep.
No.
Go.
All right, Madam Chair, I move to close meeting be adjourned and the Savannah County Board of Supervisors convening in an open session. Be resolved, the Board of Supervisors does hereby certify to the best of each member's knowledge one only public business matters lawfully exempted from the open meeting requirements under Section 2.2-3711A of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended, and to only such public business matters as were identified in motion which the closed meeting was convened were heard, discussed, or considered in the meeting.
Second.
All right, the motion by Mr. O'Brien to come out of closed session. Second.
You're pushing it.
Why? Mr.
Aye.
Chair, aye. We have a motion.
Motion to adjourn.
No. Second.
Second. Motion back. We adjourn.
Did we do it? Did we beat 8 o'clock?
Yes, it's right. Just turn the